From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is visiting Minnesota Public Radio and member station KNOW. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. On today's Fresh Air, kids and violence. First, a talk with three young drug dealers from Camden, New Jersey about who they are, why they sell drugs, and what they expect from the future. Later, we discuss the toll chronic violence takes on children with child psychologist James Garbarino. He studied the impact of violence on American inner-city children and on children who live in war zones in other countries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House says that the United States and its Gulf War allies have ordered Iraq to remove its anti-aircraft missiles from the no-fly zone in southern Iraq. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the coalition partners have delivered a warning to Saddam Hussein that his missile batteries below the 32nd parallel are a direct violation of the no-fly zone. Fitzwater declined to reveal details of the warning or to call it an ultimatum. News reports quoted Western diplomatic sources as saying that the document demands that Iraq remove its missile batteries within 48 hours or face retaliation. Following an aerial survey of the Shetland Islands, where the grounded tanker Brayer continues to leak oil, British Shipping Minister Lord Caithness has called for a full inquiry into the cause of the spill. Robert Plummer filed this report for the BBC.
One person likely to give evidence is David Theobald, the master of the Star Sirius, one of the tugs which went to the tanker's aid. He's critical of the captain's decision to abandon ship and says that by the time his vessel arrived at the scene yesterday morning, there was no one on board to take a line.
Conditions on the tanker were very bad. She was brought onto the sea and she was rolling violently, but there was the chance of getting the tanker pulled away from the coastline of Shetland. If we could have attempted to pull the tanker clear in the hours before she did ground, this would have never happened.
There's been no response to the allegations so far from the owners of the tanker, the United States-based Ultramar Corporation.
Robert Plummer reporting for the BBC. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has held talks in Egypt with a UN envoy traveling to Israel tomorrow in an attempt to resolve the crisis touched off by Israel's expulsion of 415 Palestinians. Lori Neff has a report from Cairo.
UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, an Egyptian, held talks with his second UN envoy to Israel at Boutros-Ghali's private residence in Cairo. Neither official spoke to reporters after the meeting. Earlier, the Secretary General said he and the emissary would make plans for the envoy's consultations with Israel tomorrow. The UN's first envoy was unable to convince Israel to implement a UN Security Council resolution demanding the Palestinians' repatriation. Boutros-Ghali has said he will have to recommend further UN action if this envoy is unsuccessful as well. Israel says the expulsions are necessary to battle Muslim militants blamed for the killings of seven Israelis since late October. Both Israel and Lebanon have disclaimed responsibility for the Palestinians, now stranded in South Lebanon. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The broader market remained fairly steady, but the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 3 points to close at 3,305. This is NPR. European Community human rights investigators reported today that Serbian forces in Bosnia are raping Muslim women as part of a deliberate effort to intimidate Muslims and drive them from their homes. Dame Anne Warburton, a former British diplomat who led the investigation, said that her group came across so many reports of rape that they concluded that sexual assault was being used as a strategy in the war. Serbian leaders in Bosnia have said that the reports of systematic rape are just propaganda to raise public support for international military intervention in the civil war. A coalition of anti-smoking groups is applauding the EPA's apparent decision to list secondhand smoke as a carcinogen, but the groups say President-elect Clinton and the new Congress must go further in convincing people not to smoke. NPR's Carol Ann Clark has more.
The coalition wants legislation mandating that the Food and Drug Administration treat cigarettes as it does other legal drugs, requiring full labeling of all health risks associated with smoking, and banning the use of what it considers implied health claims, such as low tar and low nicotine. Dr. Raymond Woosley with the American Heart Association says this would be a good start for a president who listed health care reform at the top of his agenda.
If the new administration, the 103rd Congress, mean to deal seriously with the health care reform issue, they are going to have to take immediate action to reduce tobacco consumption in America.
The coalition is also calling for a $2 per pack increase in the federal excise tax on cigarettes. The group says this would save some 2 million lives and bring in $35 billion in added revenue. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Jazz trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie died today at a hospital in New Jersey. He was 75. Gillespie was known as a pioneer of modern jazz, one of the founders of the bebop style, and one of the musicians who helped bring a Cuban beat into jazz. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. When I'm not filling in for Terry Gross on Fresh Air, I host a talk show in Philadelphia called Radio Times. Today on Fresh Air, we bring you an excerpt of a Radio Times interview with three young drug dealers from Camden, New Jersey. One program note, when we open the phones, don't bother calling since the program was pre-recorded. Camden is a city of 87,000 struggling to cope with the problems of poverty, dilapidated housing, embattled schools, crime, and drugs. There are some bright spots in the city and many determined to improve the quality of life there. But there were 50 homicides in Camden last year, many of them drug and gang-related. The three dealers each used aliases. They belong to the 6th and Ferry Gang in Camden. Samson is 18. He started dealing when he was 12. Kevin has been selling drugs since he was in 9th grade. He's 20 years old. And Eddie is 16. He began selling drugs when he was in 7th grade.
One day I had needed money, and one of my friends was like, yo, you might as well just start selling drugs. The first day I was like, well, why don't you just give me something? And I just started from that day. I made like $100 that day.
You made $100 first day out?
And I just started ever since. Like one point I wasn't going to school because I was making like $1,000 a week. And then, like that was like my 9th grade year. And I just started going back to school.
Let me just ask you, I mean, where do you get the drugs? Where are the suppliers? How does that work?
You go anywhere with money, you'll get it.
I mean, is there a certain look you have to have or a certain way that you know?
Maybe you might have a little, it'd be nice to have a little clientele. So, you know, if you're known for selling drugs, they'll supply you. If you're known for moving it fast, they'll supply you even faster. Mm-hmm. But if you're known for, you know, messing people's stuff up, ain't nobody going to give you anything to mess up because money is money.
We're talking about drugs, but what kind of drugs are we talking about?
Crack cocaine.
Crack cocaine. How about for you?
Well, same thing.
Crack cocaine?
Same thing.
And anything else? Just that?
That's it.
How do you know? How did someone approach you?
Well, they know our faces. They know our faces real well. And if they like your product when they buy it, they'll spread the rumor around that you got something good. You get clientele. Everybody keep coming back to you. And business is booming.
What do you do with the money? I mean, I assume you're making a lot of money. You're not telling us exactly how much you're making, but you're making a lot of money. What do you do with it?
Okay, to be truthful, okay, a job like such as a janitorial job or a teacher's assistant, we will probably make more than they do in a week, than they do in probably about a month.
So you're taking home in your pocket in a week what someone holding them, you know, a pretty good job would make it.
Somewhat around $1,400 to $1,500 a week. It depends, like I said, if you're not the lazy type.
But what do you do? What do you do with $1,400 a week?
Cars, clothes, jewelry.
Girls.
Buying cocaine, flipping it more to get you more money in your pocket.
Do you think about the fact that crack cocaine destroys people's lives? Do you think about that? I'm looking at you, Eddie.
I do, but that's just a way for me to get money. If I can't help nobody that don't help theirself, they're going to do it regardless. If they're not coming to me, they're going to go to somebody else.
You know what I mean? It's not all my fault. It's their, half of their fault, too.
So you don't feel guilty about selling crack cocaine to people?
Not really. They should feel guilty for themselves. Because I ain't the one doing it. I'm just trying to get money.
You, Kevin?
Yeah, deep down inside, I do, because I know that I'm destroying my own race. Not to mention my race, but other various races that are out there. It's not a black thing. It's not a white thing. It's a nation thing, and it's destroying everybody. All use it, and it really does hurt deep down inside. But
so why do you do it?
Like Mr. Eddie said, the money comes good. Very good. So
how do you feel about what you do then? If the money's good on the one hand, but at the other hand you feel like not only you're destroying your own race, but you're affecting everybody else.
How can I put this in?
I mean, it's a tough question.
Yes, it is. The best way to do it is, well, try not to think about it and just keep a clear head. Mm. But when you do go home and lay that head to rest, you do think about it a lot.
Samson?
Well, how I put it, you either put one to the side.
What do you mean?
Well, all right. If a pregnant lady come up on our set, where we sell drugs at, and she wants something, a couple of people won't serve her. Somebody, man, she's pregnant, don't serve her. Somebody will serve her. So if one person don't get the money, somebody else gonna get the money. Mm-hmm. So you might as well serve somebody, serve her. But like he was saying, like Kev was saying, he feels remorse, you know.
Do you?
No.
No?
No.
Not even as Kevin was saying, when you go home and you know, you have that moment to just think about what you did.
Well, I know what I did was bad. I know what I do was bad. So I'm going to just continue to do bad things.
Let me reintroduce you. And I know I'm asking tough questions, and I appreciate you being here. And let me just reintroduce the three of you. And on Radio Times today, we're taking this hour to talk to three young people that live in Camden. And among other things, they deal crack cocaine, and we're trying to figure out why and what their life is like and what sort of decisions that they make when they're on the street corner. They're part of a gang that goes by the name of Sixth and Ferry. Did you want to say something, Sam?
Well, all right, back to your last question.
Yeah.
You said, you know, do we feel remorse and all that? Well, all right, you feel bad sometimes, but then you really don't care no more. You be like, you see what's going on in the street, everybody is hard on us, thinking we bad people. People scared to walk by sometimes. Do I look like I'm ugly? I don't scare people. I'm not ugly. And excuse me for laughing.
No, it's okay.
But you just get mad sometimes at how people look at you.
What would get you to stop dealing drugs, though? Could anything get you to stop dealing drugs?
Yeah. Eventually, I will stop dealing drugs. I'm not going to deal drugs all my life.
How do you know that, though?
I don't know that.
How about for you, Kevin?
I seen really it was another way for me to get out. You know, I have a daughter, but I had her in the ninth grade. That's why, I mean, you know, for me to support myself and then plus my daughter, there is other alternatives. And I do have a job.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, that's something, you know, part-time that I do on at night, you know.
But do you think about not dealing drugs?
Yes, I do. I think about it a lot. Really what makes me think about it is, suppose if I had sold some messed up stuff, whether intentional or accidental, and the person that I sold the messed up stuff to would happen to hurt my daughter. That would really hurt me a great deal, and I wouldn't have no other alternative but to stop.
Is there any way to know that you haven't sold messed up stuff? I mean, do you...
You would know, because the complaints have come pouring back to you.
Is that right?
You would know.
Now, you're all part of a gang called Six and Ferry. Do you all trust each other?
Up to a certain point.
Up to a certain point, Eddie?
I'll let you know. As far as gangs going and protection, I trust them all. As far as drugs, I don't trust nobody.
Is that right? How about for you, Samson?
Same way.
Same way.
And gang-wise, if anybody, like, come down our way selling any other drugs, we move them out any way we can. And don't care about them. Anybody come in our neighborhood, don't know them, shouldn't care who they are.
Okay. I got a lot more questions for you, but I know our audience does as well. And my guests on Radio Times are three guys who live in Camden, and part of what they do is to deal crack cocaine. Well, let's take some phone calls and see what our audience has to say. This is Gail, and she joins us from Norristown. Gail, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, Marnie.
Hi.
My question is, what is the purpose for this program?
The purpose for this program, Gail, is to try to understand a culture and a group of people that I think we all read about but perhaps don't have a chance to talk to.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems more like a how-to program on how to sell crack, how to evade the law. I mean, do these gentlemen pay taxes on what they make?
Well, let's find out. Go ahead.
No, we don't pay taxes. That's why I think if drug dealers could pay taxes, I think it would be legal. I think more people would want to do it. That's the only reason cops is trying to come down so hard on drug dealers and everybody else, because you don't have to pay taxes. That's the way of having money.
Okay.
Some countries, drugs are not legal, but you might as well say they're legal, because that's the most money that other countries make, like in Puerto Rico and Cuba and stuff. That's how the government get paid off, by drug dealers. People don't realize it, but I read about it every day in school. That's where people mostly get their income at.
Do you go to school every day, Eddie?
Yeah, mostly every day.
Mostly every day.
I might, stay out once a week or something.
Mostly. Once a week? So you're missing like 30, 40 days of school a year?
About 20. I don't miss like one every week, but I might take a little vacation like one.
What do you do when you don't go to school?
Go to the corner.
Mm-hmm. What kind of grades do you get?
C's. At least a C average. Mm-hmm. I don't fail that many classes.
Go ahead, Samson.
The school Eddie go to, it's like the majority in the whole school is mostly drug dealers.
Exactly.
It's like a fashion show. That's what you might as well call it.
Because you see a lot of gold?
Gold, all that. Clothes. I seen a couple people. I'm in 11th grade. My 9th grade year, like this gang I was in, people used to carry guns and stuff to school. All, like, mostly it was a school of drug dealers. That's why. That's all it was.
Do people carry drugs to your, guns to your school now?
I don't know.
Can you get in if you've got a gun or a knife on you?
Yeah. There ain't no metal detector there.
There's no metal detector. You think there should be? Because they're starting to do that in Philadelphia.
Yes, most definitely.
This is Kevin.
Because that is a major protection law. It should be. Because it's innocent people getting hurt by guns. Not saying that I wouldn't hurt anybody, but if it was to come down to nowadays, okay, if it was to come down between hand-to-hand combat and shooting you, most likely I would shoot you.
You would shoot me?
That's how everybody thinks.
So everyone here has a gun? I mean, not with you? You don't have a gun? Samson, you have?
Uh-huh.
Have you ever used it?
Mm-hmm.
Under what circumstances?
You violated me, meaning you did something to try to hurt me. You did something to try to hurt one of my friends out the gang and went back to revenge them, or went back to revenge me. Or it was over crack. You owe me money, I'm going to come after you.
And you've used it?
Can't say it on the radio.
My guests are three drug dealers from Camden, New Jersey. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air. We're listening to an interview with Samson, Kevin, and Eddie, pseudonyms for three young drug dealers from Camden, New Jersey. This conversation was originally heard on Radio Times, a program I host on WHYY in Philadelphia. When we recorded the program, we took calls from listeners. Then we've got Daryl, who joins us from North Philadelphia. Hi, Daryl. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I used to sell drugs for 5 years in the early 80s, but back then it was cocaine. You cooked it up. And was like 10s and 20s. Mm-hmm. To make a long story short, I got tired of, I feel pressured. I wouldn't bring enough money in. I was getting burnt, and I was getting threatened. And I'm just having to make them a quick comment. I'm a little nervous, too.
No, that's all right. Take your time, Daryl.
I think what made me stop, I was killing my race of people, and I think it's a shame. And if we ever, I think people ought to get together and stop these guys. See, it's not a lot being said. I mean, I'm for the death penalty because I think I just have a disrespect for drug dealers, and I hate it. And I'm for the death penalty. Like myself, I used to sell it. Mm-hmm. I praise God, I'm out of it. I got tired of looking behind my back for people who are out to get me.
Daryl, how old are you, Daryl?
I'm 25.
You're 25. And when did you get out of it then?
I got out of it at the age of 20. Yeah, matter of fact, I just got out of it a couple months ago.
Okay.
Friends of mine was getting killed. And people was like, people got to get together and stop these guys from doing it. You know, my family, I got my loved ones, they got on the drug. I myself slipped, started doing it. That fast money doesn't last long. And I just like to hang up and I say, I wish them guys would stop killing our people and you know, reunite. Stop selling to the people.
Daryl, don't hang up yet, okay?
Okay.
I got a couple questions and I want to have talk to my guests here as well. How did you stop? How did you stop dealing drugs and what do you do instead?
Well, right now, I gave my life to the Lord because I felt like that I couldn't make it. I was scared and I got tired of looking behind my back.
Yeah. Daryl, do you have a job?
I do. I'm an orderly at the hospital, Franklin Square Hospital.
Okay. And are you making a lot less money than you did as a drug dealer?
Yeah, a lot less.
Yeah. And how does that feel?
Well, I don't think about it. I'm just glad that I'm still alive because, like I said, a lot of my friends got shot. I was being threatened. I don't think about it. I mean, it's a big difference now, but I just thank God that it's over.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
This is a nice show you have here. Cause I think it's educating people about this madness. It's academic like AIDS is.
Yeah.
I think this show here is wonderful.
Okay. Daryl, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Let's move on. We got David in Philadelphia. David, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. How are you?
Good morning. Okay.
I've appreciated the comments made by the young men.
Thank you.
And I do share their own opinion that they're rather intelligent young men.
Yeah.
From my own experience in the world, I'd just like to share a few thoughts with you.
Go right ahead.
If you just simply look at what you do, you are agents of death. That's all. Nothing more. Nothing fancy, nothing elaborate. That's what you deal in, that's what you do, and that's what comes after you. What you're trying to do is find a way of life. The legal system that you speak about is called pharmacology. You can get a degree in it. You can open a drugstore on a corner. You can sell drugs to your heart's content. If you have a mind to sell or do business at a level of $50,000 to $75,000 a year, which is $1,000 to $1,500 a week, America needs those kinds of minds. If you have the ability to handle money and not be corrupted about it, America needs those kinds of minds. The world screams out for young men with solutions. You see, what the man has that does not make $1,500 a week, but he has a steady job as he has his integrity to make up the difference.
And that's what Daryl was talking about.
Yeah, so you have to have, that's what makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, just having, you know, an open mind, look at the rest of the world, think about the needs in positive life. You can do it. Once you tell them that, I know I'm going to be caught, you're caught right there. As soon as you admit that to yourself, you're caught right there. And you have to admit it sooner or later because death is what you're dealing in.
True.
Thank you.
Okay, David. Kevin, you said true.
Okay, what he's speaking about is dead true. You can walk the streets and get shot for no reason, you know, being that you're out there and you know what you're doing. Some of us parents know what we're doing, some of us don't. And what he was speaking about, us being agents of death, we know that. we knew that when we first was, you know, starting into this game. You know, being it, I know people.
Do you want to be an agent of death?
No, not really. But I don't look at it like that. The best way I can look at it is I look on, like, the bright side, you know. More things for my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
The better she look, you know, the better I look. That's how I look.
You know, I'm thinking about the last three callers here. These are three men that are angry and concerned about you. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, and I'm sure, and the fellow that brought you here today, who I know, is concerned about you. When adults talk to you like that, what's the effect, especially adult men talk to you like that, what's the effect on you, Eddie? And all of you said you don't have a relationship with your fathers.
I know what they're talking is true, but no, I just got to do something to survive. I know what the last caller said, I'm an agent of death, but I know I sell somebody something that they can kill themselves with. But that's just like somebody that sell alcohol, you know what I mean? They sell somebody a fifth of brandy or something, that can kill you.
Kevin?
In this drug game, it's two things that we all want. We all want money, and we all want the power. When you have both of those, there ain't nothing you can't do. Nothing. You don't have to worry about women, fancy cars, clothes, nothing. Once you have the money and the power, because you can look cute and go to a basketball game and pull a girl, but if you walk up in the game and they know you from clientele or whatever, that's blase blah, and he sold. Money and the power is really what's it now.
But you don't have friends, as you said. I mean, real friends. You have your daughter, Kevin, but you said you can't really trust anybody.
True. So very true.
What do you think you're going to be doing in 10 years? I mean, where do you think you'll be, Eddie?
Well, I don't get court. I think I have a job. I'm not planning to sell drugs all my life just until I get out of school or until I get a job. If I get a job and I can keep a job, then I won't sell drugs no more. As easy as that.
It was estimated by one of my relatives, she passed away now, but she had predicted that I would be dead by the age of 19. You know? And
you're,
I respected
you're
her.
You're 20.
Yes, and I respected her for that because it's just her opinion. That's all it can be, you know? I'm here now, but...
You think about, though, 10 years from now?
10 years from now, I would rather be somewhere doing something positive for people. What I'm doing, I hate. But it's just, you know,
money,
source of income.
And for you, Samson?
Well,
10 years?
10 years. I play day by day, ear by ear. I mean, I go out look for a job. I know I ain't never going to get one. I hope I do get a job one day. I mean, I tried to get a job, but... Nobody, they look at me, see, he look like a hoodlum, don't hire him. So I stick with my drug business. If this is just what's going to get me big, this is just what's going to get me big.
You think about a future?
Yeah, I look at my future very good. And I feel as though I have one.
You feel as though you have one? You can imagine being an old guy, old man?
Yeah, I hope.
It's really hard to see yourself making all this money. Then on the other hand, see yourself at McDonald's. Hello, welcome to McDonald's. May I take your order? It's kind of hard, very hard.
Three young drug dealers from Camden, New Jersey. Special thanks to Barbara Bogave, the producer of Radio Times. We'll close with some music by Dizzy Gillespie, who died today at the age of 75. I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Fresh Air.
It seems that we could hear that hungry whale say, look at them cats, I'm gonna eat them up today. The whale that swallowed Jonah, spit him on the land. The whale that swallows us might not understand.
Oh, I'm gonna stay where I ought to be.
I ain't gonna let no whale make a meal out of me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. How are all the violence and guns in America's inner cities affecting its children? Coming up, we talk with child psychologist James Garbarino, who studied children living in inner cities here and children living in war zones in Central America, in Africa, and the Middle East. He says the experience of violence is the same for both groups, but often the children in our inner cities are more demoralized. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The United States, Britain, France, and Russia handed Iraq's UN ambassador an ultimatum today. It demanded that Iraq remove surface-to-air missiles from southern Iraq or face a new military confrontation. The missiles are on the ground below the no-fly zone, where Iraqi planes are forbidden to penetrate. Several Iraqi aircraft have ventured into the airspace, and one was shot down by a U.S. jet. Iraq said it reserved the right to retaliate. The Iraqi ambassador said today that the missiles are in the zone for purely defensive reasons. President Bush submitted his last budget to Congress today. The document predicts a deficit of $292 billion in the next fiscal year, $18 billion more than was projected 6 months ago. The new chairman of the House Budget Committee dismissed the document. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Martin Szabo says Mr. Bush's farewell budget is not a serious document. Szabo, a liberal Democrat from Minnesota, was elected chairman of the Budget Committee today by his House Democratic colleagues. He is succeeding Leon Panetta, who has been named budget director by President-elect Clinton. Szabo says he believes Americans want the deficit cut and the economy stimulated.
They, I think, have to work in conjunction. I suppose it's in some ways a chicken and egg question, because unless the economy is moving forward, our ability to reduce deficit is not great.
Szabo's job will be to shepherd Bill Clinton's budget through the legislative process rather than preparing an alternative spending plan, as has been done under Republican administrations. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Senate confirmation hearings for Bill Clinton's cabinet appointees got underway today. Ron Brown, Clinton's choice for Commerce Secretary, faced a few tough questions. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Republican members of the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee questioned Brown about his lobbying efforts for a dozen Japanese electronics firms and his representation of the Haitian government under the dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier. None of this is illegal or, as many argued, even immoral. Brown has said that if confirmed, he would drop any financial interest in his law firm. For the most part, however, today's hearings were marked by their lack of confrontation. Committee members spent more of their time questioning Brown about what role he envisions for the Commerce Department than they did about his personal business dealings. Confirmation hearings for other nominees take place later this week, but the full Senate won't vote on any of them until after the January 20th inauguration. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
Federal auditors say firms hired to operate casinos owned by Indian tribes have cheated the tribes out of at least $12 million. The Interior Department's Inspector General says the government should keep a closer eye on those casinos. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed mixed today, losing nearly 3 points to close at 3305.16. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is National Public Radio News. Gale force winds are forecast for tomorrow and Friday off the Shetland Islands, where a tanker remains stranded and leaking crude oil. The British shipping minister has said cleanup crews will try to board the ship tomorrow, but the forecast could force them to wait. High winds and waves have prevented divers from getting close enough to judge whether any of the cargo can be prevented from spilling into the sea. Environmentalists have reported an increasing number of birds and fish killed by the oil slick. The co-chairman of the Geneva-based peace conference on former Yugoslavia met today in Belgrade with Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic. But there were no clear signs that a breakthrough had been reached in the peace process. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
After a four-hour meeting, negotiators Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen said that the peace process is at a critical stage. Vance said that they all agreed that they must find peace. Slobodan Milosevic, the man the West accuses of having fomented the war, said he supports an immediate cessation of hostilities in Bosnia, but he didn't say whether he would try to persuade Bosnian Serb leaders to accept the peace plan. Yugoslav Federal President Dobrica Čosić made a dramatic appeal on television this evening, saying Serbs face a choice between military and political surrender and a military attack by the most powerful nations of the world. But Bosnian Serb leaders were adamant in their demand to create a Serbian state within Bosnia, which runs counter to the Vance-Owen plan that wants to maintain Bosnia's territorial integrity and independence. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
About 100 Bosnian Serbs gathered to celebrate Orthodox Christmas today at a mass in Sarajevo, despite the danger posed by Serbian heavy guns in the hills around the city. Serbs in Bosnia tend to be Orthodox Christians, while another faction in the war, the Croatians, are mostly Roman Catholic. The traditional midnight mass starting Christmas Day was moved ahead because of curfew. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. In a perfect world, childhood is a time to explore and experience life free from anxieties about danger and violence. But for many children, from Somalia and Bosnia to American inner cities, violence is a daily occurrence. More and more, young people in cities like Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles witness violent acts, beatings, stabbings, and murders in their own homes and neighborhoods. They're acquainted with the victim. They know the perpetrator. Many have been victims themselves. Child psychologist James Garbarino has been talking with children in war zones around the world to find out the psychological toll that chronic violence has on their development. He's the director of the Erickson Institute, a research and education center in Chicago. Garbarino is a leading authority on how children cope with war and violence. He's co-authored several books on the subject, including No Place to Be a Child and Children in Danger. He's talked with children in Iraq and Kuwait after the war in the Persian Gulf, in the West Bank and Gaza, in Mozambique, Cambodia, Nicaragua, and in America's inner cities. I asked him what children in all these war zones have in common.
In some inner city neighborhoods, by the time kids are 15, more than 30% will have witnessed a homicide. More than 70% will have witnessed a life-threatening assault. That's not fundamentally different from what people have found in war zones around the world. What is very different is that typically in a war zone abroad, the community and the family is likely to be intact and functioning. There's likely to be a collective sense of identity and some group purpose that the war is to serve some purpose, even if it's one you don't agree with. And finally, that there is the prospect of a way to end it, that there is a possibility of a political settlement that will produce an end to the hostilities. When that hope disappears in war zones abroad, you get the kind of demoralization and depression and violence within the group that I think you find in American inner city neighborhoods.
In talking to children that grow up and live in war zones, do they want to talk to you about the violence that they have to survive?
Well, I'd say it depends. A lot of kids are quite willing to talk if they get the message that you really want to hear about it. Some kids kind of test adults to see if they're really ready to hear, if they're willing to hear. It's very threatening for adults to hear these messages. Most adults find it very disturbing to think that children are being traumatized, that children are having these experiences. Parents particularly are often overwhelmed with guilt and anxiety to think that their children are having it so bad. Most of the children realize how upsetting it is to tell their parents that things are bad, and so they try to protect them from that, they keep them from that. It's also humiliating often for the child to admit that they feel so afraid. So they may be keeping it back, and the parents also may not be asking, in part because they don't know what to do if they hear the answer. Often professionals don't ask because they don't know what to do when they hear the answer. We've spoken with teachers in public schools in Chicago who said that they had discontinued having show and tell, you know, the traditional show and tell where you open up the floor to kids in kindergarten and first grade and, you know, tell what you want to tell about, share your experience. Significant number of teachers discontinue that because they don't know what to do, or they can't deal with their own feelings when the kid says, well, I want to talk about the body that was found outside our building over the weekend.
So you're really saying that more and more children are having less and less of an outlet to talk about the violence in their lives because the parents or the adults can't listen.
I think that's often the case, yes.
For children that have witnessed a murder, what do they tell you? What are some of the stories that they've told you, and how do they express what it is that they've seen?
Well, in the immediate aftermath, often they're really highly aroused, and that's part of what trauma is. It's this overwhelming arousal. It's kind of having your circuits blown by something that is just too much. In the first minutes and hours and days sometimes, they're really shocked, as you might expect. They may be very, very quiet, or they may simply be unable to stop talking about it, wanting to rehearse and report the event over and over again. After that initial period, children generally kind of develop a more deliberate account, a deliberate story of what they've seen, and they may want to kind of get beyond it and may even be reluctant to talk about it because they see how adults respond. The most common reaction of adults is after a relatively short period to try to give children the message, well, forget about it, it's over, put it behind you. And children receive that message and then often stop publicly talking about it. But in fact, they really need the opportunity to come back and to recover that ground a number of times. And so they may want to draw it out and tell you a story about the drawing. They may want to hear your interpretation of what they've told you and then revisit it again next week or next month.
James Garbarino is my guest today, and he's the president of the Erickson Institute, which is located in Chicago. He's an authority on the effect of violence, community violence on children, the author or co-author of several books, including No Place to Be a Child, Growing Up in a War Zone, and his latest called Children in Danger, Coping with the Consequences of Community Violence. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with James Garbarino, and he's an authority on the effect of violence and community violence on children. What do you see as the difference between TV violence and flesh and blood violence? If a child witnesses a television program and they see someone gunned down on the tube, and they look out their apartment window and they see someone gunned down on the street, how do they process that?
Well, you know, the answer I would have given a few years ago was pretty straightforward, that the research on the impact of television violence has told us now, accumulating over 30 years, that most of the effect of watching television violence occurs among children who've had real-life experiences with violence, that there's a kind of interaction between having had violent experience in your real life and seeing it on television that amplifies the effects and leads to more aggression on your part. And I think that's pretty well established. Now, just taking it that far, that means that as more and more kids have real-life experiences with violence, they become more and more vulnerable to violence on television. And that would be kind of one answer. But in recent years, I think we're seeing children exposed to a type of television violence which is really different, qualitatively different from what went before.
How so?
Well, I think that the exposure of children to, but through cable television particularly, through the access to VCR, which brings into homes movies that, you know, might never be shown on television, and the increasing tolerance of television, both cable and broadcast, for really pornographic violence means that more and more children are being exposed to violent images which are so powerful that they can be traumatic in their own right.
I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I want to ask you, just in this vein, comparing the kind of trauma of the Freddy Krueger movies and children observing that, and the kind of trauma that you see in fairy tales, where oftentimes children are abandoned by their parents and raised by wicked and ugly stepmothers. Would you say that's also a trauma for children? I know many people that were traumatized by many of the Disney movies, of course, the Dumbos and the Bambis.
Mm-hmm. I think that the traditional fairy tales, some of them have certainly these very powerful and potentially traumatic themes to them. The saving grace there is often that they are verbally produced, or verbally communicated, which protects the child in some ways from some of the images. It's still true that those stories can have this upsetting and even traumatic effect on children if they're coupled with real-life experiences that the child has. But there is this kind of mediation of the message through the words. My real concern is that the modern televised violence, the Freddy Krueger violence, doesn't have this mediation. It is a direct assault on the child. I would say it's like, you know, teaching children about violence with Freddy Krueger is like teaching them about sex through showing them hardcore pornography. Mm. The imagery is just too much for the child to deal with, given what they know, given their intellectual abilities, given their cognitive abilities. It's just too much for the child. And when you figure that a couple of people when they've done little surveys, have reported that something like 15% of the first graders that have been asked say they have seen the Nightmare on Elm Street movies or the Halloween movies. And you add to that, I know when I go around the country and talk with professional groups, if you ask people who work as child therapists about these movies, over and over again they will talk about how these movies, the Freddy Kruegers and so on, are caught up with or implicated in the problems that they're seeing with young children who are emotionally disturbed. I think it's a kind of wild card that's been thrown out into the culture, and it would be bad enough if there was nothing in real life to echo those films or to resonate with them. But if a growing number of kids have real-life experiences which are threatening, and then they are exposed to these kind of vicious media images, I think there's a real potential for harm.
I'm speaking with James Garbarino about the effect of community violence on children. Do you see that inner city schools should move more into the social services realm, move beyond the three R's?
Well, you know, the reason I got involved in child development initially was that I was a classroom teacher, actually in a junior high school. And when the 10th kid came in, you know, drunk or had been arrested by the police, I decided that my ability to do the job in the classroom was being undermined by what was going on outside. And I think that's an important recognition that all schools have, that your ability to function in the school depends a lot on the quality of life outside the school. And so it's incumbent on schools to take a leadership role in looking at the quality and the texture of children's lives the other hours of the day so they can do their job better.
Well, what do you think about bringing in peacekeeping forces the way we've done in Somalia to bring some kind of order to the chaos of the inner cities?
Well, I think the UN concept of peacekeeping is probably an important idea for some inner city neighborhoods, because you have a kind of catch-22 going on where the police force cannot do the job because of the overwhelming social problems, and the social services cannot do the job because they're not physically safe. So what you need is, I think you need a strong emphasis on community policing, which might be the kind of domestic equivalent to the UN peacekeeping force, where the police are taken out of the cars, put on the streets, a lot of storefront kind of substations for the police, a lot of meetings between the police and local community leaders, where citizens have a sense that they and the police are allies in trying to take back control of the streets. And then you add into that this human services, social services mixture, and then you have something which has a chance of making a difference. Somalia is a good example because it's very clear from the news reports that just sending in the Marines in a military way only provides a very temporary solution and is not going to produce long-term security. However, when the Marines move into this larger role of building up local resources, of training local security forces to maintain control, of allowing enough safety in which a political process can take place, then you can get real peacekeeping.
In a minute, we'll continue our discussion with James Garbarino about children and violence. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Robert. What do you have for us?
Well, we have news today, Marty, of two deaths in the arts. Rudolf Nureyev died today, and Dizzy Gillespie also died, evidently, of cancer of the pancreas in his sleep. Nureyev, after what his doctor described as a cruel illness, will have obituaries on both men. Also, a report on how Somali women's lives have changed during the fighting and the famine there, and how life for Somali men may also change after the violence subsides and they have to live with the women.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. I'm talking with child psychologist James Garbarino, co-author of the new book, Children in Danger. We've spent this time really talking about the violence on the streets, but I wonder, looking at the violence that often happens inside of homes, the kind of domestic violence that children have to cope with, is that a more dangerous violence psychologically when it's happening inside the home?
I'm glad you mentioned that because I think will be growing evidence, and there's already some, that just as the kids who are most vulnerable to TV violence are the kids who have real-life violence, the kids who are most vulnerable to the violence in the community are the kids who have violence at home. That rather than immunizing you against further violence, it heightens your vulnerability. So the kids we're most concerned about are kids who are abused and neglected at home, who then go out to face a violent community. They're the ones most likely to be infected by that violence. They're the ones most likely to be drawn to it. And in fact, if you drew a map of most cities like Chicago and put pins on the map for all of the domestic violence cases, the child abuse cases, the children who are killed by parents, and then put pins on the map for all the community violence cases, you would find very similar patterns. That there's a tremendous overlap. It's the catch-22 of American life, that those who are at risk the most in one way typically are at risk the most in another way. And, of course, the other thing is that what is community violence from one perspective may be domestic violence from another. If a kid is beaten or a wife is beaten inside an apartment or on a porch of a house, that's domestic violence for them, but it's community violence for everybody else.
You've really described a very dark and depressing issue, this whole issue of urban violence. You also said you never want to give up on a particular child, but do you feel that there is a generation of young people now getting into adulthood that are just lost? I mean, they have lost their childhood and they're lost as adults.
Well, I think under the current way of dealing with them and thinking about them, they may well be lost in the sense that if we continue to respond with incarceration as a way of dealing with the drug economy, they probably are lost. We have one of the highest incarceration rates around. There are neighborhoods in our cities where, two-thirds of all the young men between 18 and 30 either are in jail, awaiting sentencing, on parole. And every time we send someone to a prison, You know, we're sending out ripples of destruction in that life, in that family, in that community. So I think that has to change. We have to find some other way to deal with those young offenders, or we really will sentence that whole generation to economic and social disaster. No way around it, I think.
You're an authority on this whole issue of violence in children. Has that changed you as a parent?
Well, it certainly has placed a lot of demands on me as a parent. I have two children, and at least a couple of ways. One, I really have to be very careful about screening and monitoring kind of what I talk about at the dinner table. You know, I was in Kuwait at the end of the war. I'll probably be going to Croatia and Bosnia later this month. And bringing home those experiences, which I need to talk about, I need to write about, is something I have to shield my own children from.
Do you have to control the impulse to want to rescue or adopt all these children that you've spent time talking with?
I certainly do. In fact, I've been working on a novel about that has a clinical psychologist who works with children in war, partly as a hobby. And in the novel, the psychologist has adopted a child from every one of the war zones that he's been to. And it was clearly a kind of wish fulfillment in the novel.
So if you can do it in fiction, it helps in real life.
That's right. And that, you know, that is a very strong impulse that lots of people have to rescue a child. It's understandable. It generally is the least adequate response. As an example, I've been working with the government in Spain, and initially they wanted to bring over thousands of orphans from Bosnia and Croatia to come into Spain and be adopted, and they had 10,000 Spanish families who wanted to adopt these kids. And after talking about it and going over the history of this sort of thing, I think they came to realize that saving individual children like that is a very small part of the solution. And now they've changed the focus of the program. They're bringing mothers and children, they're bringing families, displaced families to Spain for a period of time to make them safe, to help them rebuild before they go back to their country. So the immediate solution is not always the best one, and rescuing individual children, while emotionally appealing, is not nearly so important as investing in protecting communities and making communities safer. And that's a tough lesson for any culture. I think it's particularly difficult for American culture, which responds so well to the plight of the individual child, often not seeing the context of the family and the community that child is in. And if you rip the child out of that, you may well be doing more harm in the long run than if you find a way to support the child in that community.
James Garbarino, thank you very much for talking about children and the effect of community violence on children. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
James Garbarino. His books include Children in Danger and No Place to Be a Child. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Vablaitis, and Thad Kirk. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The wounds that Lewis Puller experienced in Vietnam profoundly affected his life. So did growing up the son of Chesty Puller, a military legend. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Lewis Puller. His prize-winning memoir is just out in paperback. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.